You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Historian and journalist Fergus Bordewick tells the story of the creation of our nation's capital in his new book, Washington, The Making of the American Capital. It is a story largely about slavery and the politics of slavery. Bordewick says the story of the making of the Capitol serves as a sort of national parable, in his words, embodying the central contradiction of America, persisting even today between noble intentions and the sordid realities of power. Early in his telling of the story, he says, Washington, D.C. was born from one of the most intense political struggles in American history, one shaped by power politics, big money, the imperatives of slavery, ferocious sectional rivalry, and backroom dealing, as well as by idealism and single-minded determination. On the program today, the founding and construction of the District of Columbia. Fergus Bordewick is our guest. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments for our guest. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333. That's 333-9455, 333-WILL. And then we also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Fergus Bordewick, is the author of five books, including Bound for Canaan, the epic story of the Underground Railroad, America's first civil rights movement. In addition to the books he's authored, his work has appeared in such publications as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Smithsonian, the Atlantic Monthly, and Harper's. His new book, Washington, The Making of the American Capital, is published by Amistad, an imprint of HarperCollins, and you'll find our guest online at www.fergusbordewick.com. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Bordewick, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure to be here.
You note that as the nation began recovering from the War of Independence, Americans were repelled by the idea of a permanent capital as it evoked memories of Europe's monarchies. So how and when did the leaders of the young republic begin thinking about a capital?
Yes, well, this is a remarkably volatile question that tormented, indeed even, you might say, tortured the leaders of the early republic. The nation needed some kind of seat of government, and that was, in fact, the term of the time. Capital had a European kind of imperial ring to it, which people of the time didn't even like to use. So anyway, they generally spoke of a seat of government. During the Articles of Confederation period, just after the Revolution, the capital had sort of rolled from one city to another, and nobody was very happy with that. Once the Constitution was signed, the idea of a permanent seat of government took hold, but where was it going to be? More than 30 different localities competed.
Yeah. The new republic was quite fragile. How fragile?
Hardly anybody believed it was going to survive. Of course, looking back after more than 200 years, we see the United States like the Washington of today, so to speak, as rather immutable and, one might even say, imperial in some ways. And indeed, it has survived longer than all but a few governments in the world. But in 1790, the time of the first Congress, the country was only three years old, barely even that. Congress had begun sitting only in 1789, but the Constitutional Convention was a bit earlier. The country was catastrophically in debt. The United States was the third world of its time, in hock to European bankers, unable to pay its debts. Different states were profoundly jealous of each other. They issued their own currency. Thomas Jefferson, when he traveled from his home in Virginia to New York City, the temporary seat of government in 1790, had to use three different currencies, and it drove him crazy. There are many, many more examples of that. Congress itself was a pretty tentative thing. About a third of the United States senators selected in the 1790s basically just walked off the job because they didn't like it. They just left.
we were Iraq.
We were Iraq, pretty nearly so. And to an extent, we were even still war-ravaged. New York, as I mentioned, was the seat of government in 1789 and 90. And war ruins were still visible all around the outskirts of New York City. Earthen bastions and burnt buildings and things of that sort. So it's not an outlandish parallel.
Yeah. As I mentioned in my introduction, this story of the creation of the Capitol, this permanent seat of government, is largely a story of slavery and the politics of slavery. And one of the interesting things to think about is the Continental Army and the outcome of the war and the outcome of it. The Continental Army, you say, was the most racially integrated force in the United States, fielded until the Vietnam War. What role did slaves play in the war for independence?
Yes, gosh, that's a fascinating and large topic. Initially, many, many enslaved Americans welcomed the Revolutionary War because they heard or picked up second and third hand the revolutionary rhetoric that was in the air, talk of natural rights, human rights, and so on, and the idea of equality. And a great many slaves, one way or another, believed that it would lead to their freedom. That hope was, by and large, bitterly disappointed. However, now on one hand, huge numbers of slaves, the largest hemorrhaging of slaves in American history, took place during the Revolution, but primarily on the part of enslaved people who fled to the British, who promised them freedom. Others did indeed fight in the Revolutionary Army. And indeed, it was an integrated army. Black soldiers fought in the same units with white soldiers, which, for example, did not take place in the Civil War. Although a great many black Americans fought in the Civil War, they all fought in segregated units, and that continued right up until well into the 20th century. So there were African Americans on both sides. African American soldiers fought heroically in a number of the key battles of the Revolution, most notably the Siege of Yorktown, where black troops in the Rhode Island Regiment spearheaded the attack on the key to the British line, which brought the British to their knees and caused them to surrender.
Hmm. The fighting side by side, Africans and Europeans in the Continental Army, was that controversial?
It varied from state to state. There was intense opposition to arming black Americans in the southern states, even though there was a proposal in South Carolina by a man who was the son of one of the most successful slave traders in South Carolina, John Lawrence, to arm slaves in return for giving them their freedom. That proposal died a sudden death in the South Carolina legislature. In the northern states, which all of which, by the way, were slave states, although Massachusetts had in effect terminated slavery at the time of the 1780, in the midst of the Revolution, there were slaves in every northern state. New York State, where I live, had more slaves than Georgia at the time of the Revolution. However, the northern states were gradually emancipating slaves. The handwriting was on the wall. Everyone knew slavery would end. And the proportions of slaves in the population were not that great. So there wasn't the same kind of terror of armed slaves or former slaves as there was in the South. So in the northern states, integrated units were not uncommon, and there's no bias that I've seen on the subject.
Mm. In the light of this service, was emancipation debated following the war, and how was it debated?
Yes. The answer is a qualified and circumspect yes. It was debated. Though many of our founding fathers, particularly those from northern states, but by no means all of them, and a few from southern states, believed that emancipation was logically inevitable, given the principles on which the Revolution was fought. There were many, many other founding fathers, however, who believed that it was both economically and socially impossible. The Constitution itself compromised and refused to incorporate emancipation, though it was certainly discussed. Emancipation was such a fraught and frightening subject that when in the first Congress in 1790, precisely at the same time as Congress is discussing where to put the capital, Quakers, in the first organized lobbying campaign in American history, grassroots campaign, Quakers, sort of figuratively speaking, burst through the doors of Congress, but they did literally go around knocking on congressmen's doors, calling for Congress to commit itself to emancipation. And you had essentially a political meltdown over this. It was something so frightening politically. It was so widely believed that it would split this newborn country in half that the Quakers were suppressed. Even Northerners who tended to support emancipation, gradual emancipation, wanted the Quakers out. It was considered just too dangerous to discuss.
Yeah. You know, to us, it's hard to imagine. You know, but here we have a grassroots movement, not a very big one, but really feared by Congress. We can get that part, I think.
It reflected the fragility of the country. As we said a few minutes back, the country itself was so shaky, so new, its future so uncertain, its strength untested, that people on most sides of the political spectrum worried that anything that threatened to divide, to upset the delicate compromise that had brought the states together, just had to be shut down, suppressed, not talked about. And slavery was by far the most potent issue of that type. And it should be said that it made some of the founding fathers profoundly sad and unhappy, Alexander Hamilton being a case in point.
Yeah. What an interesting character he is, and he plays a large role in this story, as does Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and others who are less well known to us. But before we move on to those men and get to how it was that a site on the Potomac was selected, let's talk a little bit more about the politics of slavery. There was some debate about a ban on the overseas slave trade. That would have ended the importation of slaves. I found this really fascinating. Virginia's delegates to the Constitutional Convention favored such a ban because it was in their interest. Tell us about that.
Yes, indeed. On the face of it, it looks as if banning the overseas slave trade is an enlightened, progressive kind of policy. And certainly, almost everybody recognized this as an awful business. The mortality rate on slave ships was often anywhere from a third to a half. It was just appalling. And nobody argued that there was anything very good about this. Those who desired the expansion of slavery or who had a stake in it, however, regarded it as a necessary evil that was key to sustaining Southern agriculture. and we're not very concerned with the moral dimensions of it.
That
ban on the overseas slave trade was enacted. It was extended for 20 years, from 1788 to 1808. It did end in 1808. And the ban was supported by many Southern congressmen, particularly from the Upper South, as you pointed out, Virginia. Well, why would they do that? Because by limiting the importation of slaves, it automatically increased the value of the huge numbers of slaves who were owned in the Upper South. I don't want to get too technical here, but slave-based agriculture was tobacco primarily, was declining in the Upper South. Many, many, many Virginia planters had what they called surplus slaves. So long as more could be imported, it kept the value down. If importation was shut off, the value of American-born slaves would increase, as it did, dramatically. So Virginians and other Upper South slave owners had an economic stake in shutting off importation.
Yeah. So we have sectionalism at work and in the politics of slavery. Let's talk now about George Washington and those like him who favored a site on the banks of the Potomac. Earlier in the fall of 1789, Congress voted to place the nation's permanent seat of government west of Philadelphia, north of Baltimore. Why did that happen, and then what led to the collapse of that deal?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier on, there were some 30 different sites competing for the Capitol. This was a ferocious political competition. It was close to cutthroat politically. One of my favorite candidate sites was, in fact, what's today the South Bronx in New York City, which obviously didn't win. But Congress did, as you mentioned, vote to put the Capitol on the Susquehanna River, on a lovely site, which would have been impregnable to foreign attack, unlike the site on the Potomac, which was where the Capitol was burned in 1814. So why didn't the Capitol wind up in Pennsylvania? It looked like a done deal, 1789, early 1790. There was a fierce political struggle amongst Pennsylvanians between competing factions who were just so sure that the state had the Capitol. It was just a question of what town was going to get it. So while these two Pennsylvania factions duked it out, a competing interest from the Potomac River Valley, behind the scenes, led by George Washington. James Madison was the leading, front man is an accurate description, but it's a bit demeaning. Meanwhile, lobbied for the Potomac. They clearly didn't have a majority vote, but what happened was the following. It was the granddaddy of all American political backroom deals, which literally took place in Thomas Jefferson's back room,
mm-hmm.
in his home in New York City, in today's financial district. It wasn't financial district then. And Jefferson personally seemed to have brokered this deal. Alexander Hamilton, an abolitionist in sentiment, a founder of the New York Manumission Society, wanted a northern capital. But more than that, he needed votes for a brilliant plan, to stabilize the nation's chaotic finances. And he couldn't get those votes. He got them finally by way of this compromise. Jefferson, Madison, and the Potomac Valley planting interest agreed very, very sourly to yield up a couple of votes for Hamilton's financial plan in return for Hamilton providing a few northern votes for a southern capital on the Potomac. Politically, that's how it happened. But behind that, you mentioned George Washington, and George Washington is in every part of this story, and we see Washington from a number of very unfamiliar angles, and one of them here is as essentially a commercial lobbyist for the Potomac Valley. He and his fellow planters believed that the Potomac was destined to become the great American highway into the interior of the continent, sort of the Interstate 80 of its day, and that all the commerce of the world was going to come up the Potomac and be sail up the river and be transshipped over to the Ohio River and open up the Western country. It was a grand vision based on a truly bizarre misunderstanding of geography, which in itself is a great story, but not to get into it here. Washington was the chairman of something called the Potomac Company, even as he was president in his early years. It was a conflict of interest that today would be cause for impeachment, but a conflict of interest simply was taken for granted in those days.
Yeah. What led you to this story, and what did you make of Washington as you began to uncover these unfamiliar angles of the man?
Well, I came to this really in a kind of proverbial flash of insight, even though it sounds kind of self-evident now as I describe it to you. Some years back, when I was writing my book about the Underground Railroad bound for Canaan, I was describing Thomas Jefferson walking to take his oath of office in the year 1801 at the U.S. Capitol building on Capitol Hill. In reading period documentary material, I realized that he was picking his way around puddles and over piles of brick and stumps, and of course there was no city there. Mm. There was no there in 1801, and I had this kind of sudden image of not a wasteland but a huge construction site, and realized that the people building what was Washington in 1801 must have been slaves, because this was cut out of the slave state of Maryland. And I thought, why don't we know this is a city that was built by slaves? And as I bored into that, it became clearer and clearer that the politics of slavery was behind the whole development of the site as well. It became also clear that there was a degree of self-interest and venality and political manipulation and mind-boggling financial manipulation as well behind the creation of this capital city that was, one, a largely untold story, and second, that it seemed to show the kind of dilemma or the kind of struggle that the United States has seen over and over and over in its history up to the present day between, as you said at the beginning, noble ideas, noble ambitions, and they were there in the creation of this great symbol to weld together the fractious states, noble ambitions, and sordid political realities, and I mean, a profound degree of self-interest, and not to say even corruption in the development of the place.
Yeah. Why have we been slow to see this story that should be so obvious?
Well, I think we Americans, probably all nations, but we possibly more than others, have a deep, deep desire, need perhaps, to see ourselves in a noble light. Look at the founding document of our country, or at least those parts of it we choose to emphasize, the Declaration of Independence. How many Americans, by contrast, are really aware of the terrible compromise in the Constitution that declared slaves to be but three-fifths of a person in order to grant excess representation to the southern states in Congress? I mean, there's a sordid political reality coupled to a noble aspiration. In the same way that after the Civil War, we airbrushed the horrors of Reconstruction and the the appalling oppression of freed African Americans, the way that we airbrushed that out of our national story because it didn't fit the noble story that we prefer to tell ourselves. How the troops of the Northern armies won the war on the battlefield, and politicians lost it in Congress in the 1870s and 80s. So again and again, I think we see this habit, and perhaps I think you could say that we have scripted, until very recently, the national script for Iraq has followed the same kind of principle, where we've far too many Americans, I think, have rather gullibly believed an administration line that one success was following upon another, and we were building an Iraq free from model Middle Eastern democracy, even as it was disintegrating into incredibly bloody and stomach-turning chaos.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is historian and journalist Fergus Bordewick. He tells the story of the creation of our nation's capital in his new book, Washington, The Making of the American Capital. It is largely a story about slavery and the politics of slavery. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Jefferson said he abhorred slavery, but of course he owned slaves. That day when he was stumbling across the District of Columbia, or what it was called at that point in 1801, what do you suppose was going through his mind about the slave labor that was being used to build the Capitol?
Yeah, well, Jefferson is a fascinating figure when looked at through the lens of slavery. His mind, I mean, he was almost schizophrenic on the subject. I'm using that figuratively. He wasn't literally schizophrenic. The words that he penned in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, became the banner of the abolitionist movement in the 19th century. And yet, as you point out, he was one of the largest slave owners in the state of Virginia, and he freed no slaves except those who were the family of Sally Hemings, his longtime black enslaved mistress. Jefferson, as the historian Joseph Ellis, I think, has probably explored better than anyone, Jefferson had a remarkable ability, and perhaps this is true of many, many slave owners who believed that they were enlightened men. He had an ability to hold absolute contradictions in his mind simultaneously. Soaring idealism and an obliviousness to the moral consequences of his actual behavior. So what was he thinking that morning? I think he took slavery absolutely for granted. And as his life went on, he increasingly became interested in defending the prerogatives of the South, and that included the excess congressional representation that the South enjoyed because of its slave population. Slaves couldn't vote, but southern states got congressional representatives based on the headcount. To the end of his life, increasingly, he defended that. He deeply feared the possibility of a massive slave rebellion, as occurred in Haiti, if there was universal emancipation in the United States. He shared Southern phobias on that score in his marvelously written but sometimes very troubling work, Notes on the State of Virginia, fascinating work. He describes African Americans in terms that in the 21st century, it's really quite hard to read. He reflected all the kind of ugly color prejudices that we became familiar with later in the 19th century on the part of much less cultivated defenders of slavery. He described African Americans as having bodily habits, smells, and impulses that were repellent to white people, and so on, not to repeat them.
Yeah.
And yet, his principle of all men being created equal did indeed become so deeply embedded in American culture and in all our psyches that we continue today to extend that vision of liberty to minority groups of all types, not only racial ones.
Yeah. The time is so fleeting here. It's going so quickly. I want to talk about a couple of characters in this story, a couple of men who are very interesting, who are more than likely unknown to most of us. I'll leave it at that. Benjamin Banneker and Dr. William Thornton. You want to talk
sure.
with us about those two men, and then we'll talk about a speculator and a con man.
Okay. That's a very nice pairing there, Banneker and Thornton. Benjamin Banneker was one of the most remarkable men of his time and recognized as that in his own day. He was an African-American born free in the state of Maryland, almost never traveled until 1791. He was a largely self-educated astronomer and mathematician of a very high order. He became friends with a Quaker surveyor, a very eminent man named Andrew Ellicott, who George Washington tapped to survey the federal district, the District of Columbia. And Ellicott, in turn, invited Banneker to join him as his assistant, performing very complex astronomical readings with a telescope that were used as part of the surveying process. So Banneker is, one, a fascinating and brilliant man in his own right. He's also the only African-American whose life is recorded in detail who participated in the creation of the federal district. Now, I mean, that's a very qualified way of putting it, because bear in mind that the preponderance of the labor was done by enslaved African-Americans. Nobody bothered to record what they thought, even though we do have records of their names and their work. And there were a few other free African-Americans who we know by name. But Banneker stands out as a towering and fascinating figure. William Thornton was a remarkable man, a polymath, a Renaissance man, if you like, who was born on a slave plantation, a sugar plantation on the Caribbean island of Tortola, was educated in Britain, and was converted very young to abolitionism, came to the United States fired with a vision of emancipating American slaves and personally leading them back to Africa and creating an African, a Christian enlightened African nation in West Africa. That never quite happened. Thornton was a man of many ambitions. He was an inventor. He invented glass. Well, he tried to sell the American Army at one point on glass cannonballs. Perhaps not the most clever idea, but he invented a universal orthography, a way of transliterating languages that would apply to all languages. And he also designed the United States Capitol building as part of a contest. There were many submissions. He won. He designed the Capitol sitting on his family's plantation on Tortola. He had gone there in a hope of emancipating Tortola slaves. He couldn't accomplish it. He was in despair. He entered this contest. He sat there on the plantation designing the Capitol building, and he won. And he came back and presided over its construction.
Let's, before the time gets away from us, let's talk a little bit about the labor that built the federal district. You said we know names, we know the work they did. What kind of work did they do? What do we know about how they lived?
Yes. First thing, I think, and this isn't very pleasant, but it's the truth. I think we have to, when we think of the creation of our national capital, Washington, D.C., imagine a slave labor camp. Most of the work was done by slaves. Not all of it. There was some free labor. But the commissioners who actually at George Washington's direction, oversaw the work. All were slave owners. They liked slave labor. They wanted more slaves. They did not like free labor. It was obstreperous. That's to say, free workers complained. They wanted to be paid better. They caused problems. Slaves didn't. The slaves were rented by the commissioners from area slave owners. Now, we're not talking about giant numbers, but remember, our nation was very, very small at the time, and we're talking about many hundreds rather than many thousands of slaves. And we're talking primarily about the construction of the U.S. Capitol building and the White House and a few other public buildings, as well as private residences. Slaves do pretty much everything except the finest skilled labor, but some of that as well. Slaves cut down the forest. They clear the land. They cut the roads. Cut timber. They saw lumber. They work as carpenters. They work as stonemasons. They bake bricks. They mix mortar. They put up walls. Some of them are indeed skilled, very, very skilled carpenters and stone workers. There's one really tantalizing figure whose name I'd like to mention.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Chloe LeClaire, and I believe that she is probably the only African-American woman who was part of the construction of Washington, D.C. It's not 100% clear that she was African-American, but she was the nurse for the infirmary for slaves, for injured slaves. And it seems impossible that that would have been a white woman. The name also hints at probably a Haitian immigrant. And she's one of the forgotten figures of our history, but there she is. I think we'll probably know more about her in time to come.
Hmm. Well, now let's talk about a speculator and a con man, Robert Morris and James Greenleaf.
Yes, indeed. These are, well, dare I say, I mean, these men are in a way so awful, in the sense of being, their manipulations are so exaggerated in the federal district that they're among the most fascinating people to write about. Robert Morris, to be fair to him, was one of the most famous men of his time. He was the treasurer of the United States, and toward the end of the American Revolution, he was a patriot. He was very close to George Washington. Washington, in fact, rented his house in Philadelphia when the Capitol was in Philadelphia. He was a man of outsized appetites on every score. He was a speculator who acquired many millions of acres of land on the frontier. And he was part of this trinity of speculators. The third was a man named John Nicholson, who cornered the real estate market in the Federal District. James Greenleaf was a Boston con man and speculator, a hustler, who really played George Washington, and indeed he even played Robert Morris, a smart man, like Rubes at a country fair. And these three men, including Nicholson, built an empire of land that included pretty much everything in the District of Columbia. It was an empire that built on debt, nothing but debt, and that finally collapsed around them, that in a way that resembles nothing so much as the mortgage meltdown that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
It is indeed. I mean, it's really that part of the story is sort of is also an edge of the seat political and business thriller. You can't believe that these guys are going to pull another fast one on George Washington, and then they do. And all three of them, by the way, wound up in debtor's prison in Philadelphia, and one of them died there.
Mm. How did George Washington get through all this?
George Washington, and I have to say, even though he was self-interested in developing a Potomac capital, nonetheless kind of rises above the mud, as he does in several ways in revolutionary history. He kind of transcends his own class and what seemed to be his limitations, because he believes totally in the new nation, and like the soldier that he is determined that he's going to make it work. And Washington becomes essentially, as president, the micromanager of this whole project. He takes it on because he sees it's a disaster. And there are many things that we haven't talked about in this conversation. It looks time and again as if the whole project is just going to fall to bits. It's going to be abandoned. There's not going to be a capital. And the nation may even divide over this failure. Washington presses ahead. He treats it as his last military campaign. Washington was, frankly, not so great on the battlefield. But in this campaign, he wins. He pushes the commissioners. He pushes people to work harder. Every time there's a failure, Washington says, we're going to continue. We're not giving up. He dies a year before the deadline. And this is a race against time. The project has to be completed.
10 years?
In 10 years, yeah. By November 1st, 1800, or it reverts to Philadelphia. And Washington dies a year earlier than that, but in the great memorial to George Washington isn't the obelisk in Washington, it's the city. It was completed really as an offering to him, to his memory.
Mm. Well, here's one way to, maybe we can share this with our listeners, one of the ways you put the task ahead of Washington at the outset of one of your chapters is the Capitol was essentially an abstraction, an act of political imagination imposed on a blank space. You know, there's nothing, as you said earlier, there's no there.
Yeah, this is a remarkable creative act. If you want to see it from that angle, and I do think that's an important way to understand it as well, the creation of the city wasn't just a bricks-and-mortar operation. It was a very complex collective work of art that involved people like Washington, at times Jefferson, William Thornton, Pierre L'Enfant, the French immigrant designer of the plan of Washington, of the city of Washington, and so on. And it required a feat of the imagination to see a city where there was nothing. And there is both nobility and brilliance in that, even though it's entangled with these rather distressing political and financial shenanigans. And like any work of art, I think the creators just didn't know whether it was going to work. They didn't know whether it was going to be any good. Most people thought it was going to be a disaster.
And you mentioned L'Enfant. He certainly vexed Washington.
Yes, L'Enfant, and he called himself Peter L'Enfant, by the way. He Americanized his name. Served under Washington in the Revolution quite heroically. He was a brilliant designer and was regarded as the best in North America in his day. But he was just an impossible neurotic, and he had a stunning knack for turning friends into enemies and a weird compulsion to just keep building. Whatever project he took on, he kept making it bigger and bigger and bigger until it totally ran away from him. And George Washington, I was about to say, was tearing his hair out. I suppose you'd say he was tearing his wig off and stomping on it virtually. L'Enfant was driving him to such distraction. And he was fired after about a year on the job. Washington regretted it, but he fired him. He was impossible to work with. He was setting landowners and other folks at odds with each other. And L'Enfant, who was at the pinnacle of American society in 1790, one of the most celebrated men in the early United States, finally wound up descending into poverty and anonymity and died in the 1820s, utterly penniless, a charity case, wearing rags and living as a charity case on somebody's plantation in Washington. With a certain sort of poetic irony, was buried with that family's slaves in 1827, I think. L'Enfant, to his credit, incidentally, was an anti-slavery man.
Hmm. I think that this book should be required reading in Washington.
Well, it's kind of you to say that. I think that it does tell a story that's a mirror for ourselves as we still are today,
mm-hmm.
and for the and we can see by looking at our ancestors of 200 years past how the inescapable darker side of our nature and of our nation is entangled with that soaring, lofty, idealistic side, which exists too. I mean, this isn't the point is not to tear down the founders as hypocrites, although some of them were, and nearly all of them had a dimension of hypocrisy that is not so pleasant to look at. But that as we discussed earlier, you know, we as Americans, I think, have often had a characterologically or culturally a hard time looking with a cold, honest eye at how we actually act in the world and in our own society. And I think looking at the way our ancestors created this city, we can see them in, we can see both sides of the moon, so to speak.
Mm. Well, there are so many stories within this book, and overall it is a remarkable work. I want to thank you for writing it and also for talking with me this afternoon here on the program.
Well, thank you so much, Celeste. It's been a very good conversation. I appreciate the many provocative questions you offered.
Historian and journalist Fergus Bordewick has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author most recently of Washington, The Making of the American Capital. You will find our guest online at www.fergusbordewick.com. And his name is spelled B-O-R-D-E-W-I-C-H.